It was only a mile of fencing. A task order from the Army Corps of Engineers to Marcon Engineering looked straightforward. Build a section of barrier along the Mexican border. Then they started digging. The project turned into a years-long legal battle. Eventually, a judge handed the government its head on a platter, almost. Joining us with facts and lessons learned from this case, procurement attorney Joe Petrillo, a partner at the law firm Petrillo & Powell. Joe, good morning. Welcome back.
Good morning, Tom.
All right, so this was it seems like everything connected with that southwest border fence turns into trouble. In this case, it seems straightforward, but when they found out what was underneath the ground, all of the contract provisions seemed to kind of fall apart. Tell us what happened.
Well, this is, as you said, about a mile-long section of the fence along the Arizona-Mexico border. It was originally estimated by the Army Corps of Engineers to cost almost $12 million. Which seemed to me like a lot of money for a fence, but anyway.
Well, that's not just a bunch of posts and rails, I guess, huh?
No, it's pretty complicated. The contractor put in a proposal and a price of $5.4 million. And the Corps seemed to think, oh, gee, that's a great price. Let's take it. But they didn't really look too carefully about why it was that much lower. And that's how this dispute played out. They accepted the proposal, and the contractor started building the fence. And the Corps noticed, in designing and building the fence, and the Corps noticed that there was a section of the drainage that didn't conform to what it thought the contract required. So there were back and forth about that. The Corps insisted on adherence with the original specs. A lot of things ensued, and all of them involved additional cost. So at the end of the contract, the contractor put in a claim for additional costs for the drainage solution. And the contractor's position was, look, we told you in our proposal what we were going to do. It was inconsistent with some of these restrictions in the solicitation that went through into the contract, and you accepted the proposal. You also incorporated the proposal into the contract, so you have to let us do what we said in the proposal. The Corps said, no, that's not the way it works. The original solicitation restrictions apply. They're in the contract. You had to abide by them regardless of what was in your proposal, and off they went to the Court of Federal Claims.
So it sounds like a sort of classic case of where each side figured what it submitted in paperwork would be what the other side would understand to be the conditions of the contract. But
yeah,
in fact, they came with totally differing expectations.
That is absolutely right. I mean, if you look at where the parties were on this, you didn't have what we lawyers like to call a meeting of the minds, you didn't really have a situation where they were expecting the same thing. So the court is now charged with cleaning up this mess. And the judge looked at the evidence and decided that, at least on this issue, the contractor was to prevail. Court held basically that the government lost for several reasons. The first was that the evaluation was extremely cursory and superficial. It was pretty obvious from the contractor's proposal, according to the judge, that they weren't going to abide by these restrictions regarding drainage and the solicitation. There was no indication that anyone on the technical evaluation panel even noticed that, much less brought it to the attention of those negotiating the contract. And the judge points out that if they had, this would have been a topic of discussion, and it would have been resolved prior to the contract being awarded. In addition, it might have led to an amendment of the solicitation and change in those restrictions. And you have to think back to when the contract was being negotiated, perhaps that kind of a change would have given other contractors a better shot at the contract. But anyway, that didn't happen. The government was also supposed to perform a price realism analysis. It said it would do that in the solicitation, didn't do that. And then you have this glaring discrepancy in which the contractor was proposing a price that was about half the government estimate. So there were several dropped stitches there.
Well, from the look of the solicitation, or as it was summarized by the court, it looks like almost as if it was two projects. One was the bollard fence. I mean, this is some kind of bollards, 18 feet high, 6.5 inches thick, and 4 inches apart. That's a lot of bollards.
Yeah, and big ones, too.
Yeah, 18 feet by 6 inch. I don't know what the heck it would be made of. I guess steel or concrete, whatever. But then the whole drainage deal, because I guess the anchor for the fence would cause flooding, and so it was supposed to build some kind of a sluiceway for all the flooding to go from one end of the fence to the other and out to wherever it was going to drain.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like the drainage project and the fence project were together but separate, and that the company only bid on the fence part.
Well,
and didn't hide that fact.
It didn't hide that fact, and there were two parts of the drainage process that the court held were impossible to do together. One was that the project had to handle the type of flood that only happens in 100 years. These days they seem to be happening more often than that, it seems, down in Texas. But the other part of it was that the drainage work had to be contained within a certain portion of the site. And the experts, even the government expert, agreed that you couldn't meet both requirements. In order to meet the 100-year flood requirement, you had to extend the drainage out beyond this section of the site, and that's exactly what the contractor proposed to do, and that's what they ended up doing. So they did meet at least one of the two requirements, but to do it, they had to relax the other one. And the court said, look, they substituted a feasible way of doing the work for an impossible one, so the government was better off because of that. The final thing that's interesting, at least to a lawyer about this case, is the government claimed that since there was an inconsistency between the proposal that was incorporated in the contract and the specs that were also in the contract, the order of precedence clause should apply. And that tells you what applies in the event of a conflict. The court didn't think there was a conflict, but even if there were, it noted that the order of precedence clause favored the contractor. The unfortunate thing about this issue for the government was that they had two order of precedence clauses in the contract, and of course, you only need one, and if the two are different, they're conflicting with each other, so that leads to a sort of double mirror situation in which the conflict gets bounced back and forth between these clauses. The court disposed of that by saying, look, government, you wrote the contract or that portion of the contract with those two clauses, and if there's any ambiguity here, you've got to bear the burden of that.
We're speaking with Joe Petrillo, a partner at the law firm Petrillo & Powell. And so I guess a couple of questions or lessons learned come out of this. First of all, the Army Corps of Engineers, you would assume, would know these things, like if it had incompatible specifications, like a ditch that could handle a 10-year flood and it's asked to handle a 100-year flood. And so it seems like it was almost conceived wrongly from the beginning because of these conflicting specs, and then written badly because of the conflicting orders of preference.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, people do make those mistakes in the early sections of contract drafting, but there are three other lessons, I think, that you take away from this. First of all, the technical evaluation panel has to look more carefully at the proposal, and if there is a discrepancy between the proposal and the solicitation, then you've got to resolve that during the negotiation process. I think the government has to give some thought to putting better guidance in the regulations about when to incorporate proposals and when not to incorporate proposals. Thirdly, if you're going to draft a contract, make sure it only has one order of precedence clause and not two, because then you start creating ambiguities.
And what about the idea of oral presentations or discussions? Is it possible for a contractor to have those, or is it legal for them or proper for them to have those after the RFQ is put out but before anyone submits a bid?
Well, certainly the contractor, if it notices a problem in the solicitation, ought to be pointing that out to the government in questions, oral or written, to certainly most RFPs require written contract, written questions, not oral questions, so as to resolve those inconsistencies. But you know, bidding's a very fluid process, and getting all the parts to work together can be very difficult and challenging for both sides.
So, if a contractor sees these kinds of discrepancies, suppose they notice that there are two orders of preference, or they notice that, well, we'll give you an 18-inch culvert, but it's not going to be able to do a 100-year floodplain. No 18-inch pipe or whatever it was ever could. What is the best course of action if you still want to bid on it?
Well, I think the contractor did exactly what it should have here. It said what it was going to do, and it made it clear in its proposal how they were going to address this issue and how they were going to resolve this this problem with the specifications. The government apparently just didn't pick it up, and eventually, that's why the contractor's position prevailed.
And, of course, we should point out this dates back to 2008, so this has really been winding through for a long time.
Well, unfortunately, litigation's not a quick process.
All right. Joe Petrillo is a partner at the law firm Petrillo & Powell. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.